Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have with us from Atlanta, Georgia, my friend Don McLaughlin. Don, how are you today, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, now, truth be told, many years ago, I don't want to say how long ago it was, but I interned as a youth intern at the church where Don is a pastor in Atlanta, Georgia. It was a while ago, though.
Yeah, yes, you did. And you've worn your age way better than I have in years.
I was just thinking about this, and your daughter was, I think, in sixth grade then. And now she's married, graduated college and seminary. Yeah. And that makes me feel very old.
Yeah, well, she's doing great. We're really proud of her and her husband both.
Well, you are the source of plenty of folklore in the world that I live in. There is a folklore that when you first came to Atlanta, you had a conversation with the elders at your church, and it went something like this, where you said, do you guys just not care about racial reconciliation, or are you just bad at it? Did something like that actually happen?
Yes, it did. It's pretty close. When I first was trying to determine if God was leading us to Atlanta, we came to visit, and I don't know what I was expecting, but I think I was expecting more racial diversity, and you know, and I was kind of stunned. So my very first question that I ever asked the elders here was this: do you not know how to reach out to people who aren't white, or you know? Let me back up here and think here. It was actually, do you not want to reach out to people that are not white, or you on purpose, or you just don't know how? And one of the things that really touched me was the response. The response was very quick and clear. We don't know how.
And you don't have a job at this point when you ask that question.
Oh, no. Which spoke vividly to the future, you know, like, hey, you know, and I asked them, is this something you want to pursue?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you know, and they've definitely proven that was their heart right from the beginning.
Really? So, how did they prove that?
You know, over the last 17, you know, well, first of all, they hired me, and you know, over the last 17 years, I have watched them take just step by step by step in ways that are obvious. Like if you come to our church, it's crystal clear that that's their heart, because you see, you know, the wonderful mixing of humanity. But it's behind the scenes as well, in how they imagine, you know, leadership and how they think about the future and how they think about conversations and what they're willing to entertain demonstrates that they had a serious heart about it. And to be, you know, also, you know, candid, those that didn't want to be a part of that didn't stop the process. So they either got on board, or some of them decided that maybe, you know, being a part of another church would be their preference.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of thinking changed? Was there specific ideological shifts that happened over these, you say, 17 years you've been there?
Yes, yeah. But I will actually start with a story on myself. One of our elders, African-American guy, he and his wife, terrific mentors in my life. She gave me this article written on race, and she gave me the article, had me read the article, and asked me, you know, hey, what do you think? And I was like, man, yeah, hey, that's a great article. And she looked at me and said, that's the problem. It's not a great article. And she handed it back to me and said, you need to read this again. And I was like, oh my goodness, because you know, it's always a bummer when you think, man, you've really nailed something and it's crystal clear that you haven't.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that made me feel so confident about our future is that she felt comfortable to let me know, you're not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not seeing it through the correct lens. So that was a real help. And I can kind of elaborate on the lens she was trying to get me to see that changed us, I think.
Really? So that was one of your elders who handed you this article and you kind of dropped the ball on it?
It was one of our elders' wives.
Okay. I was trying to ask a very nice way. Is that a woman elder you guys have now? Or I didn't know that. Okay. So elders' wives give you this article and tries to get you to think through. Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
When you're there, was that something, as you show up, you're expecting more diversity because that's where you came from? Like, I don't even know where you're from originally. I know you were in Indiana before You moved down to Georgia.
Yep. I grew up in Oregon. And of course, you know, that is a different culture that I grew up in. But I think what I thought, Luke, was, wow, you know, Atlanta will be like X. Yep. You know, you have this history of Atlanta. You have this, you know, this kind of a broad conversation in Atlanta. A lot of our most noted civil rights leaders either came from Atlanta, were connected to Atlanta. So I guess I kind of thought that, hey, you know, the conversation there will be way down the line. And it is further down the line than average.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, and as I discovered, that the church has not always been on the forefront and still is not on the forefront of leading the conversation the way that it could be led.
Why do you think the church isn't on the forefront of that?
Fear.
Fear. How so? What is fear doing?
I think what happens is that a lot of times churches move when they feel like the wind is at their back.
Okay.
Rather than moving into the when the wind is in their face and saying, you know what, following our leader, Jesus Christ, we're going to step into this thing with our ears open, with our eyes open, with our hands open, and say, how do we participate with the people we're with, wherever we are in the world, mm-hmm. to help the kingdom become a reality in this place? And a lot of times what happens is we are either afraid of the reaction of people that are a part of the church, or we are afraid of the reaction of people that are not a part of the church. And so I think fear is a function. And then I think in our own lives, I think that, of course, we all struggle with the selfishness and mm-hmm. all the things that keep the status quo, you know, yeah. firmly embedded.
Why do you think it's so hard for churches to make the move to step into the wind, as your metaphor would put it, when it seems like so obvious in the Bible and Jesus is teaching that we should be about including everyone, the kind of diversity and community that God is calling us to is not this all white, all right kind of community. It's everyone together. How come it's so hard for us to step into the wind?
I think that's a great question. Okay, here's something that I really absolutely believe, and not everybody may agree with this, but I believe that people will be more confident to do something if they have at least some equipping, you know, like if they have a little bit of an idea that, hey, try this, or experience says this. And so I think information and education is just such a big part of the process.
Really?
Because what I've discovered, Luke, is people can have beautiful hearts, but if they don't know how to move forward, they probably won't. And even in fact, I've met many people, like in our church, who are doing a great job leading now, but they were worried about making the situation worse.
Hmm.
Like, you know, they weren't sure what to do, so they thought, man, I don't know what to do, and I don't want to make it worse. So I think equipping is a really important component of the church stepping into the wind.
So if someone comes up to you and says, I want to work towards racial diversity, I want to work towards being a part of reconciliation, and you're going to equip them, what is the first step, what is the first piece of the puzzle that you're going to hand them as you're starting to educate them on reconciliation and how they can participate?
Okay, one of the very first things that we will do is I'll hand them three words. And the three words are, tell me more.
Hmm.
So you step into a conversation of any kind, not just a conversation about race.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody says, well, you know, you realize that the problem, like somebody might say something, well, you realize that the problem between whites and blacks is, and then they articulate their thought. Well, our tendency is to immediately react to that by either saying, yeah, no kidding, or no, well, that's not the way it is, da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
And the better approach is just to listen really well to somebody and say, wow, could you tell me more? Tell me more about that. Because then that allows that other person to feel more safe, to explore, and to start clarifying and articulating themselves. See? So they might say, Well, you know, I mean, I guess not all black people or not all white people or okay, well, maybe not every, and they are doing the articulating, which makes the conversation so much more rich rather than just kind of categorical bantering back and forth.
Yeah. Okay, so let's think about how this three-word phrase, tell me more, can apply to Ferguson. Obviously, that's kind of the situation that's in the news that is breaking everyone's heart. And I heard in your sermon on Sunday that you have a friend who lives in Ferguson.
Yeah. So I gave him a call, and I was like, hey, you know, I would like to know a little bit about what's going on. You know,
see, black or white guy?
White.
Okay.
And so he said, hey, he said, you know, first of all, you know, clearly the entire town is aware, it's on edge, but not everybody is engaged to the same level, you know. So he told about during the week when all the protests were going on, of course, he's still doing some business, you know. And he said, so, you know, obviously the awareness in the news is, you know, kind of concentrated in a particular area. And he said, but here's a couple of things. He said, first of all, you know, you have to bear in mind that these neighborhoods and these people, you know, are like everywhere else. They're just like everybody else. You know, their concerns, like if you take the Brown family, you know, if you could turn back time to the 8th of August, the 7th of August, the 6th of August, the 5th, well, they're like every other family that has an 18-year-old son. You know, you know, I've raised five young adult children. Four of them are boys, you know. So I was thinking, well, what was it like when our boys graduated, the summer between when our boys graduated, when they went off to college? You know, what was that like? You know, so if you could turn back the clock to the 8th, 7th, 6th, 5th, well, what they're concerned about are the normal things. You know, how is our boy doing? Is he making the transition? You know, the normal the moments of concern that a family has, the normal moments of being proud of your child, the thoughts about that. I loved what his grandmother said. His grandmother said, you know, he was moving forward. You know, he was making his way. See, that's what she was thinking about on the 8th, 7th, 6th, 5th. And so this friend of mine, he said, you know, what's hard to realize is if you could just turn back time to before the 9th and think about the town, the families, the people, well, Darren Wilson, you know, the officer.
Yeah.
Think about what was going on before all this hit. And it was many of the normal things that every community in America is struggling with now. What this has allowed us to do, though, and I really appreciated one of the articles I read, is this exposed once again that the progress we think we've made is not as far along as we'd like to believe it is. And what we've got to recognize is we have not been as diligent and vigilant as we need to be about cleansing our culture of institutional racism, of systemic racism, of systematic racism. These are big issues. And Ferguson is showing us once more that we've got a lot of work to do.
Do you think as the white community in America sees this situation, do you think most of white America is going, I thought we were kind of over racism. Do you think white America has the assumption that they have cleansed, in a lot of ways, systematic racism?
Wow, Luke, that is such an important question. That's a great question.
Well, you're the expert. You have to answer the question.
Okay.
I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay. Yeah, you're great. That is such a powerful question. Let me address it just in a couple of quick ways. One, no, I don't think that in a broad sense, white America is kind of feeling like, yeah, we've got it all fixed. Here's what I think. I think there are segments of white America who are kind of like, man, is that not old news? Didn't we get that fixed?
Yeah.
And I think there are segments, and then I think there are pundits that go with those segments that kind of feed this idea that, hey, this is all like old news kind of stuff. But then I think there are really broad segments of white America that are tied to their students, tied their children that are students, or tied to universities, or tied to, you know, urban renewal or whatever, that are aware that, no, we are not where we need to be. Now, I would say this. I would say that if white America will embrace those three words, tell me more, over lunch, over coffee in people's homes, I think we'll get a lot further along than we even are right now. And I'm even talking, Luke, about the people that I feel like are pretty aware. Mm-hmm. But if you go back to when this elder's wife, Donna, hands me that article, and I am feeling at the time at least moderately aware.
Yeah.
And then she's like, no, man, you are not getting it. Then what that did for me is that said, you know what, Don, you are going to have to let go of the confidence you have in your ability to sort this out apart from friendships and community that go across the lines of ethnicity.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw this, but there was a supposed Facebook post from a store owner in Ferguson, a white man standing in front of a storefront that had been burned down. And supposedly this happened, and it was on the internet, so who knows if it's really accurate or not. But supposedly he said something about, as white America, we burnt this down because we have taken away the hope of all African-American people, not all, but taken hope away from African-American people, and we have caused this to happen ourselves. And so you have one picture of a white American who realizes his part in the equation. And a friend of the show, Dr. Christina Cleveland, would talk about how if you're white, you benefit from systemic racism. Like yeah. you have privilege, white privilege, because of the oppression of other people. And so you have some people who are willing to let go of the pride and say, yeah, I'm part of the problem. And others can't get there. Others want to say, no, this is the choice they're making. Look, they're right. And I'm saying, what do you think causes one person to have one attitude and the other person who is going to be the person who's going to have their attitude projected by the pundits you were speaking of earlier?
That's so good. Okay. One of the things that we've done here in our church family as we work through all of this, and we work through it openly, is we talked about the difference between systemic oppression and systematic oppression.
Okay.
And of course, in the U.S., or in our history, in our current world, we have both, right? And so the benefit, now this is going to feel...
Can you explain the difference of those before you go on?
Yes.
Okay.
And this is going to sound a little weird, okay? Systematic oppression is where you actually use the structures of your culture in order to, by policy and legal precedent, to actually create inequity that benefits the dominant culture.
So, can you give an example of what that would look like?
Yeah, systematic oppression would be not allowing people wrapped in a darker color to own land, to vote. That's a systematic. And there's also kind of lesser known ways like, okay, well, we're going to ban all these types of housing from this zip code.
Okay.
Well, then that is an clear economic process that is legal. But what it does is it automatically keeps certain people away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's systematic. Here in Atlanta, in expanding our MARTA line, which is our bus and subway system and so on like that, then there were counties that voted to not allow MARTA to expand into their area. So that's legal. You know, they used the legal structure.
And so this is probably a more affluent area that doesn't want access to their affluent area by people who have to use public transportation.
Exactly.
Gotcha. See,
so systematic is where you are using the policies and the legal structures. I'm not saying those structures are just. They're not just, mm-hmm. right? But they're legal.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, highlighted by Hitler, you know, things like that, right?
Yeah.
Systemic oppression is where the cultural trends that are acceptable and can be managed by the majority keep a group of people oppressed. Okay? So, for instance, you might actually have to pass a systemic law to a systematic law to stop a systemic oppression. Okay? So systemic oppression could be where anytime a person wrapped in an unacceptable color comes into your establishment, you don't serve them, you give them very bad service, you know, you're critical of them, you know, you're going to kind of make them eat on the other side of the screen, so to speak.
Okay.
See? And so the hope is that eventually the people in that unacceptable color will quit coming in here.
Are you talking kind of like Jim Crow?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So one of the things we stress to our church is this. Now, this is going to sound weird, Luke, but the benefit of systematic oppression is it's easy to indict. Mm-hmm. You see, it's easy to indict Hitler.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to indict the laws that were perpetuated in America that kept people of color out of a university based on color.
Yes.
You know, so those are easy to indict. The difficulty of systematic oppression is it's really hard to trust because after you even change the laws, because it's like, wait a minute, you knew you were oppressing me and you did it on purpose. And now that we've changed the law, I'm supposed to feel good about walking forward with you. Good grief. You know, so that's very difficult. Now, on the other side, the benefit of systemic oppression, and I know this sounds so weird, is that when the lights come on, when people have that aha moment, when the epiphany hits and someone realizes, you've got to be kidding me, what was wrong with me? Why was I treating people that way? And the people that were oppressed see that devastated reality in that person, and they experience the empathy and the repentance, and they're just like, please forgive me, da-da-da. Well, see, then it's easier to move forward in trust.
Yeah.
Because you realize, okay, wow, they get it. The downside, Luke, of systemic oppression is it is so hard to indict. People don't want to believe they're a part of it. The store owner doesn't want to believe that they're a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the guy that made the confession you referenced.
Yeah, that's true. And going back to what Christina Cleveland was saying, I mean, if you're white, you have benefited from being white. I mean, there's definitely some privileges. And one of the things that has been breaking my heart is you hear these lines from an African-American parent who's saying, yeah, I've got to teach my son to walk in a store with their hands in their pocket. Yeah. I've never thought of having to teach my kids that. Never thought about it. But that's still having to be taught by parents. Yeah. And as a white person, I go, well, what can I do to fix that? How can I help that? And I think your question to tell me more, I mean, that's a great place to start.
Yeah. Okay. A couple of really important things here. You know, my daughter, not too long ago, posted some things about this on her Facebook site, and it spurred some really healthy conversation. And one of the things that, here's one of the things, Luke, that people get confused about. I will hear people say that, you know, you talk about white privilege, but, you know, the poorest of the poor are the white rural areas of America.
Yeah.
Okay. That is so valuable. That information is very valuable. That information is very helpful. We need to say to those people, tell me more, right? Tell me more. Mm-hmm. It goes both ways. But here's the issue. One of the things I stressed to those folks is I said, I think we're getting confused when we're talking about privilege. I think we're thinking outcome, like, you know, money, advancement, you know.
American dream stuff.
Yeah, we're not talking about that. We're talking about access because, see, any person in white rural America who gathered together enough money to go into the restaurant, go into the Woolworths, go into the department store. If they had the money, they could just go in.
Mm-hmm.
There was not any resistance as long as they had the money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same thing was true with our universities. Any poor white student who could somehow come up with the finances to go to college, we didn't have to call in the National Guard to with guns to guard a poor white student to make sure they could go to school at the University of Mississippi.
Yeah.
See? So what we've got to recognize is that when we're talking about privilege, we're basically talking about an acceptable color.
Mm-hmm.
Or gender or whatever it is. So we got to clarify what do we really mean by white privilege?
Mm-hmm.
And how are we using that term? Because that's important. And I understand why people wrapped in a lighter skin who have had devastating circumstances, you know, where they've been poverty stricken or whatever, are like, privilege? Are you kidding me? And what we need to do is clarify, well, what do we actually mean by privilege. White privilege? We're not talking about silver spoon here. We're talking about access based on a color of skin that's acceptable and a color of skin that was not acceptable.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Ferguson. When we think of what happened with the 18-year-old young man that got shot, it seems that you only have two options if you read the internet. And the internet would say you are against all police force and that you believe all police officers are racist, or you are in support of oppression. Like you have, it seems like there's only two options. And do you think as the details unfold about what happened, that there's a way for people to be supportive of the police force and also be supportive of African Americans, or is it an either or situation?
No. I think you've hit on something really, really, really important. Okay, yes. I think right now it's really hard to move beyond the dichotomous approach, either or, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple of guys that are really good to read is Paul Lederach is one of them. The Moral Imagination, Paul Lederach. And the second guy, William Urey, The Third Way. And basically what these guys are kind of promoting is that there's probably somewhere in the midst of all of it, there is a way to discover how to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for instance, you know, Captain Ron Johnson, this guy is really an important figure in the Ferguson situation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I loved was this. A local person said he carries himself with disarming empathy.
Mm.
I want to meet the guy just because of that. You know, he stood in his uniform when he apologized to the Brown family,
mm-hmm.
and said, I wear this uniform and I should stand up here and say that I'm sorry. The embodiment of your question.
Yeah.
Can you be in support of the African American community and what they're going through,
mm-hmm.
and in support of the police? And Ron Johnson says, I hope so.
Now we're talking about Ron Johnson. He's a highway patrolman who's African American,
yes.
who was
yes.
brought in like the day two. To take
yes.
over the situation. Do
exactly.
you think that happens if he's not an African American?
No. And the other benefit is he's 27 years on the force. He's local.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows people. And one of the things he also said is, I'm a father. I have black children. You know, so part of the reason that he's the right guy is the color skin he's wrapped in.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. But part of the reason he's the right guy is because he has the training, the experience, the temperament. He has the expertise to lead the situation. And what we really need there is an excellent leader who can connect with the community, which he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, I think that's really powerful.
I think it's an awkward predicament because as I read the story, and I think this is a tendency for most people, is that you read into one side of it the story that you are most like. And so I look at that story and I go, I've never been an 18-year-old kid in inner city Ferguson or anywhere. I never had an 18-year-old African-American son either, but I have been a white guy, late 20s, early 30s, however old the officer is. And I have plenty of friends who fit that description. Yeah. Dozens of friends who fit that description. And I think of them as really good people who do what that guy does as a police officer.
Yeah.
And it's easy for me to interpret those stories in such a way that it supports my opinion of my friends who I read into that situation. Do you think that's why it's so important to have pre-existing relationships across the table so that you can see both sides?
Yeah, I think that's really, really wise. You know, I've thought a lot about this, and you can imagine this, Luke, because I have four sons. I have three that are white and one that's black.
Mm-hmm.
So I have raised these sons. I have, interestingly enough, two of our sons are 28, wow, going on 29. One of them's black, one of them's white. You know,
yeah.
And so when I look at those sons and I think about Darren Wilson seems very young to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's a man, he's got a family, the officer, you know, I get all of that, but he seems young to me. And I see into his situation. I think about his parents, I think about his family, I think about his extended situation. So it's hard for me to 100% vilify Darren Wilson.
Yeah.
But I have to accept that part of the reason it's hard for me to do that is I have two 28-year-olds. And I have plenty, I know plenty of 28-year-olds who aren't living the most noble lives right now. So I'm looking at Darren Wilson through the lens of two outstanding sons, right?
Yeah.
So then I have to step back and remember when, and Luke, this is a tough part of our journey, but we have had three very, very unfortunate experiences with our son that's black, that's wrapped in a darker color in regard to police.
Really?
Oh my goodness. One time, all of the boys were together in a vehicle. They got pulled over. I think it was for a taillight or something like that. He wasn't even the one driving, but he was the only one of all of our sons that was put in the patrol car.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah.
How'd that make you feel as a father?
Oh my goodness. I'll get to that in a second. I mean, you're just at wit's end, mm-hmm, when you find this out. And when our other sons come in, and he's not the only one that's trembling. They're trembling. Like, I live in a community where this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all sitting there pulling out their driver's licenses. What is going on here?
Yeah.
Okay. Then a second one. This terrific. We met our son that's wrapped in a darker color. we met him when he was 13. He had this terrific mentor in his life that had stepped into his life, and he's remained a part of his life. And he lived in one of the counties in the Atlanta area that was one of those counties that rejected MARTA coming in. But this guy, you know, clearly engaged our son and demonstrated in multiple ways, social ways, private ways, public ways, that, man, I'm engaging with you even though the two of us are not wrapped in the same color, we're not wrapped in the same experiences, da, da, da. So he was going over to visit him, got pulled over by the police, and again, what's the question? Why am I being pulled over? No ticket is given. No charges are given. The police officer asks him this question in this way. Boy.
Oh.
What are you doing in this part of town? And, well, I'm on my way to visit this person. Finally, he's on the phone with me, shaking. The officer brings in a canine unit and searches his vehicle. Of course, there's nothing in the vehicle. And I am out of my mind angry. But my responsibility as a dad is to help my son process this, not just for me to process it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, it happens a third time in another community. And that time, that was the end of it. So I call the mayor pro tem. I call him on the phone. We have a relationship with him because our church does so much community activity, community action. I call him, hey, why don't you stop by? Sure. I bring him to my office. I point to the picture that's on the wall right here, and I will point to it.
So you turn, you point to the picture of your sons.
So I point to the picture. I said, yeah, I want to introduce you to my children. So, you know, he's looking at the picture. And I said, now I want to tell you what happened last night. I want to tell you about him and another guy from our church who get pulled over last night. The officer says their car smells like, you know, marijuana. Neither one of these guys do anything like that. One of them was a professional athlete. You know, there's nothing like that. So when they're like, they have them step out of the car. Can we search it? Of course you can search the car. There's nothing in there. They start to walk to the back of the car, and one of them says, now don't run off. Run off where? They strip tie their hands behind their back.
Oh, my.
No charges, no ticket, no nothing. And, you know, now what are you doing here? Da, 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 da. So I'd had enough of that. So I call the mayor, pro tem. He comes over. I introduce him. I tell him that story. And I said, now, here's what we're going to do next. We have two pathways we can take. Either you're going to call the police chief and you're going to set up a meeting. So that's one option. Mm-hmm. And we're actually going to have a meeting, and I'm going to be in that meeting. And we are going to talk about how you treat my son, a person of color, in this community. Now, that's one option. Or I have another option. I can call the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and I can have this conversation with them.
I'm assuming you picked the first one.
Yeah, so they picked the first one. So I get a call from the police chief. We have a conversation, and I tell him, I said, you understand that these are three officers wrapped in my color, I'm white,
mm-hmm.
who pull over these two guys who are not wrapped in their color. But I said, I got to tell you, I've got four other children who are white. Even when they got pulled over for getting a ticket, or even when they had an accident, this didn't happen to any of them. None of them. So how is it that it's happening to him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I shared, well, you know, very apologetic, one of the police officers met with our son, expressed his apologies, you know, on and on and on, which I appreciate all of that. But I got to tell you, Luke, when I started replaying conversations that members of our church have had with me, African-American members that have had with me, all of a sudden I was like, this is what you were trying to explain to me.
Hmm.
You wanted me to get this. You wanted more empathy in this. I have never, ever had to train one of my kids how to enter a convenience store. I've never had to train one of my kids how to respond to a police officer so that the situation would escalate where you get shot.
Hmm.
I've never had to do any of that.
Yeah.
And these friends of mine, these parents, were trying to bring me into a world, like in King's book, Where Do We Go From Here? He stresses the need for empathy, that nothing will change without empathy. And one of the descriptions of this is that we obey the unenforceable.
What does that mean?
That I don't have to have a law that says I would approach relationships with a person wrapped in a different color like this. No, I'm going to approach them that way out of a default of respect, a desire to know, empathy for somebody else's situation. And those are essential components to what's happening in Ferguson,
mm-hmm.
and what's happening nationally. And of course, I've had the blessing of traveling all over the world. We don't have the corner on this problem. This problem is everywhere, but we need to deal with ours. You know, you realize, Luke, this is the first time in history that Amnesty International has ever deployed a team to a U.S. site.
Wow.
First time ever.
That's pretty crazy. Why is it that this isn't just happening in America? Why do we see this with different shades of different colors, different names, different groups across the world? What is the, as a pastor, speaking to the universal problem that's causing this sort of tension throughout the world?
Okay. One of the things that we recognize is we have a drive. As humans, we have a drive for social experience. I remember one of the instructors at Abilene Christian University was speaking at a lectureship at Pepperdine. And this guy's name is Randy Harris. You know Randy.
He's been on the show a few times, yeah.
Yeah, and he made a really funny comment. He was saying that during the summer of that year, he was going to go to some part of the world and spend the summer in a community of hermits. And he actually said that. And you could tell rippling across this crowd of 4,000 or 5,000 people was the oxymoron, a community of hermits?
Yeah.
And he picked up on it and said, well, of course, even hermits need relationships. Mm-hmm. So we are driven to have a society, a social experience. But see, what that means to most of us is the path of least resistance. So this is people that speak my language, wear my color, dress like me, same basic economic experience of me. They care about me, I care about them, I fight for their welfare, they fight for my welfare. Which then means that anybody who is not like us is potentially someone who could destroy the fabric that I now depend on.
Yeah.
So rather than looking into that group and suggesting that they might really be beneficial to the fabric of our group, mm-hmm. we imagine a zero-sum economy that says there's probably not enough to go around, and we probably need to take care of us and ours first. The other issue is there is a superiority complex.
Okay.
There is this belief that those like me are inherently better mm-hmm. than those that are not like me.
Have you ever heard the evolutionary psychology read on this? Is that over time people have learned and adapted to being afraid of strangers? Because if people are outside of our group, then they're a threat to us. And that has continued to weave its way into the way we interact even today.
Yes. And here's something really, oh, man. Okay, now you ask a pastor a question. This is one of the most exciting questions, period. I believe that a huge key to what's going on in the world, United States, Ferguson, Atlanta, all of that, helped by hospitality. All right. So here's a quick thing. In the Bible, in the New Testament scriptures, the word for hospitality in the original language, the Greek of that first century, is philios xenia, which means the love of strangers. Mm. So to love a stranger is hospitality. So in those scriptures, the followers of those scriptures are taught what? Well, don't neglect to show hospitality. Show hospitality. In fact, in one of them, in the book of Hebrews, it's you need to show hospitality to strangers because in doing so, you've entertained the messengers of God. You've entertained the angels of God, you know? I mean, how much more motivation than to not blow
up? You don't want to screw that up. Yeah, you don't want to mess that one up.
You don't want to, you don't want an angel to go home and say, hey, you know, I went to so-and-so's house and they didn't want, you know, and for God to be like, what, you know? And so I looked at that, Luke, and I thought, ooh, whoa, wait a minute. So if hospitality means to love strangers and that the heart of this kingdom message is to love the other, to love the stranger, where would we go with that? So the etymology of the word hospitality is, of course, the same as the etymology for the word hospital, which means to shelter the other, to shelter the guest. So I started thinking to myself, what if a church took a hospitality challenge, that we would make it our goal to tangibly love the other, to engage the other? So we gave our church in March a hospitality challenge that every member of our church would have a meal in their home with another member of our church.
How'd that go?
Oh, my goodness. In the beginning, Luke, it was hilarious. Anxiety shot through the roof, but it was beautiful. Like, people are like, oh my gosh, I'll have to clean my house. You know, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, maybe your house
needs cleaning.
Needs cleaning. Somebody else. Oh my goodness, you know, well, how will I get ready? And I said, let me make sure I understand this. In the next 30 days, your life is so busy that there is no way in 30 days you could even have one member of our church family to your home. Well, then your life is sick.
Yeah.
And listen to this. And then I remembered, what's the etymology? What's the shared etymology? Hospital. And I asked the church, could hospitality heal us?
Yeah.
Could it heal us? So we did that. Mm-hmm. And because our church has different languages, we actually had some of these dinners where there were people there of different languages and translators, and they're posting on Facebook these awesome experiences. And I'm like, yes, God knew what needed to happen, is that the evolutionary theory, and I get it, is that we kind of evolve into this thing of fearing the stranger. What God would come back and say, yeah, maybe it didn't actually happen like that. Maybe this is the result of a fallen world, and the redemptive kingdom come back and says, but there's an answer, yeah. And that's hospitality. So we did a second hospitality challenge in July, where we challenged all of our members to have someone over to their home who was not a member of our church. And we stressed, meet people. The idea is love a stranger. Meet someone you don't know very well. Have someone over you haven't had before. And it was so exciting to see all of these traditional barriers still there, but rendered ineffective. Yeah, there was a barrier, but we're going to jump over it this time. And it was such a wonderful experience for our church to benefit with each other in that way.
What do you think had more of a benefit, the reaching out to people inside the congregation or reaching outside of the congregation? What do you think produced better stories? Answer that question.
Okay. Wow, that's a really good question. Let me think about that. Okay. You know what? On the one hand, one of our other pastors made a great point. He said, we probably actually needed to do the first so the second would be more authentic.
How so? How's it more authentic?
Hey, if we're not finding great blessing in crossing these barriers with each other, then why would you invite somebody else into that?
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to know that through the redemptive work of God, those barriers are rendered useless and ineffective in the body of Christ. And then you can say, as you're reaching beyond, when people are coming in, yes, you're going to feel at home. Yes, you're going to feel accepted. You're going to come in the door and see people that look like you in a place where you want to be. So I do think that both were necessary. They both had different challenges, but I think they both were necessary and incredibly beneficial for us.
I think that's great. I think the suggestion of just being able to say those three words, tell me more, is a great suggestion. I think that would be really helpful for a lot of us as we try to bridge the gap and invite people to have meals and gather around tables with people who are different from us. That's a great suggestion. Hey, thank you so much for your time, Don. I really do appreciate it.
Can I share with you one last thought?
Of course, Don. You can have all the time you want.
But let me go back to the elder's wife.
You used to be my boss, so of course you can have all the time you want.
What she wanted me to get out of the article. Okay. So I didn't get the right thing out of the article. So I went back and I read the article. And I understand that the desire of the author of the article was pure-hearted.
Okay.
But the article was about being colorblind.
Okay.
And before anybody just disengages from me, I do believe that being colorblind can be a pragmatic first step to maybe lowering some traditional barriers. But I want to offer a challenge. Because inherent in colorblind is this thought: if I notice your color, it will go poorly.
What do you mean?
If I have to be colorblind, meaning that I don't notice that you're white, that you're black, that you're tan, I don't notice that. Why? Why do I have to not notice that? What is the benefit of not noticing your color? Well, the benefit is that I won't treat you inappropriately.
You won't get pulled over.
Yeah, I won't treat you badly. So what it says is, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to notice that you're wrapped in a darker color, and I'll feel better about you. Mm-hmm. And you don't notice that I'm wrapped in a lighter color, and then you'll feel better about me. Well, that's ridiculous. That's the same as saying to a woman, you know, I'll try to not notice you're a woman, and I'll probably respect you more at work. What?
Well,
what it says is, be less of you for me to love you more.
Wow.
You be less of you, and then I could love you more. This is crazy.
That's, yeah.
So in 1998, this was the last sermon of the year, the very last sermon of the year, 1998, which God used to set us on our direction. I did a sermon called The Church of the Nativity. And I looked at the extended nativity scene from John the Baptist to Jesus at the temple and Simeon. And I said, okay, let's look at these people. You got an old guy, you got an older woman that's a widow, you got a young family with a weird birth story about their kid, mm-hmm. you've got an older family that have been barren for a long time and now they got a kid, you got these darker skinned guys coming from the east that are so rich that they can drop off gold, frankincense, and myrrh and still go home. A ton of money.
Yeah.
You've got white collar Zechariah and these magi. You've got blue collar and Joseph. You got no collar and the shepherds, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you've got white collar, blue collar, no collar, weird birth story with a girl that wasn't married yet, older couple, old widow, you know. And then it dawned on me, none of them are walk-ons.
What do you mean?
You know how you have a movie like Gone with the Wind, and Vivian Leigh is a walk-on? Well, no. In God's story, they were all called Holy Spirit, you know, star, angel. And God says, now pay attention to who I gathered around my son, because that's what I'm looking for. Hmm. Young and old, lighter skin, darker skin, white collar, blue collar, no collar, education, very educated to no education at all. This is the kingdom I'm building. That's what I want. So you go to Revelation 7, where it says, around the throne in heaven was every tribe, every nation, every tongue. And God says, see, I'm telling you, this is what I want.
Yeah.
And then the Lord's Prayer. What's the very first request? Thy kingdom come, thy will be done how? Well, on earth as it is in heaven. Well, what's it look like in heaven? Every tribe, every nation, every tongue. So what's he looking for here? That. So we suggested to the church, is the best the church can give God is colorblind? Like, yeah, we know you. When's the last time you went through a rose garden and said, oh, I wish they were all gray?
No.
See, so no, I'm going to notice that you have darker skin, lighter skin, because it's the glory of God. God is being revealed in your gender. God is being revealed in the beauty of how he created you. I'm not going to tell the master artist, I really want to be colorblind because I don't treat people wrapped in the color you chose well if I notice that color. That's craziness. So I probably should have said it that strongly, but you get the point.
Yeah.
So what we said to the church was, we're not going to do colorblind at this church. We're doing colorful. Mm-hmm. We're happy that we're wrapped in different colors, wrapped in different cultures, wrapped in different experiences, and we're going to see the glory of God in it. And I think that is what is desperately needed. As we're looking at another person ready to pop the three words out, tell me more, is that I actually am happy that you're not like me. Because knowing you will be better for me and for you. Yeah. So those are some ways God has shaped us.
Oh, that's good. That's really good stuff, Don. That's why you're one of my heroes. That's really good. Hey, thank you so much for taking the time, Don. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Luke. It's terrific to be with you. And thanks for what you're doing, man.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.